Welcome to this edition of the Global Health Insight podcast. I'm Pauline Chu in media relations at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. In this podcast, we'll be discussing long COVID with IHME lead research scientist, Dr. Sarah Wolf-Hansen, and Dr. Celine Gounder, clinical associate professor in medicine and infectious diseases at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine. She's also editor at large of Kaiser Health News and a senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you to both of you for being on this podcast.
It's great to be here.
Dr. Hansen, let me start with you. You've done so much research on long COVID. Remind us what long COVID looks like and what the symptoms are.
It can look like many different things, actually, which is why it's so complicated to study and to understand. It can affect pretty much any body system. So some of the most common symptoms we see with long COVID are fatigue and shortness of breath, and cognitive symptoms like brain fog or loss of concentration, loss of memory. But it can also lead to GI symptoms or headache or insomnia or skin rashes. It can really manifest in many, many different ways in the body. So we see some symptoms that are really common. Post-exertional malaise is another really common symptom. But we also see some other rarer symptoms associated with it as well.
And Dr. Gounder, it's so perplexing because, as Dr. Hansen had mentioned, it's sort of a range of symptoms. What are some of your big unanswered questions about long COVID?
Well, I think, first of all, it's helpful to break it apart into two big categories of long COVID. So you have the people that got COVID pretty early in the pandemic, before we had vaccines, who had very significant organ damage, in particular to the lungs, to the heart, to the kidneys. And so it's damage that occurred at the time they had that initial COVID infection, where they were probably in the hospital for that. And that damage is just not reparable. It's not curable damage. And so that, you know, might include scarring of the lungs, it might include heart failure, kidney failure. So that's sort of one category of long COVID. The other category of long COVID are people who might have had a fairly mild infection, relatively mild infection at first, but then develop more significant symptoms later on. And that's the kind of long COVID we're seeing much more now frequently. And that type of long COVID in particular, we are not as clear as to what is causing that mechanistically. And so that makes it more difficult really to treat and manage that kind of long COVID.
Well, have you been able to make a distinction between what long COVID looks like from pre-Omicron infections as opposed to Omicron infections?
It's less about Omicron or which variant per se, and really more about, did somebody have any kind of immunity prior to their COVID infection, prior to developing long COVID? So the people who had no immunity, so it's really people in the first year or two of the pandemic who got COVID might have had COVID pneumonia, COVID infection of the heart or kidneys causing failure of those organs. And we're seeing much less of that kind of COVID now. It's other manifestations of COVID, for example, the just general inflammation, the blood clots, those kinds of aspects of COVID that we think are causing the symptoms, the disease of long COVID now.
Dr. Hansen, I'm curious to know if you've seen any disparities in long COVID after doing your research of over 1.2 million people in 22 different countries. Are you seeing differences in terms of who's impacted more, men or women, and differences in race or age groups?
Mm-hmm. So we are. In our data, we look at any cohort data, follow-up data from around the world that follow COVID patients over time. Currently, our analysis includes data from the first 2 years of the pandemic, and we're updating that this year to include Omicron cases. And what we're seeing in those data is a very clear disparity that women have a much higher risk, about twice the risk as men, of developing long COVID. And children and young people under age 20 have about half the risk of men. And so we are seeing those clear differences. Among adults, the risk across age is mostly defined by the severity of the infection. So if severity increases with age of the initial episode, then the risk of long COVID would also increase. But a mild case for young adults versus a mild case for older adults, we're not seeing a clear age pattern there. It's mostly a difference between men and women that we're seeing a large disparity.
Dr. Gounder, piggybacking off of what Dr. Hansen just said, do you know why women are more at a higher risk of long COVID than men, and why it seems that children are a bit more protected from long COVID?
I think this is also why, you know, going back to what I was describing about the two big categories of long COVID, the long COVID that results from organ damage during the infection versus this later long COVID that you can get even after a mild infection. It is important to tease that out a little bit, because if you think about who's going to have severe organ damage, who is at risk for that? It's going to mean older people, men actually more than women, and racial minorities. So Black, Hispanic, Native Americans have been at higher risk for more severe illness. And that's probably a reflection of higher rates of underlying comorbidities like diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure, and the like. But if you focus in on the long COVID that people can get even after a mild infection, and the type of long COVID that's more common today now that people have immunity, prior to having a COVID infection, for that group, we do see that women are higher risk. And that is probably because there's some sort of autoimmune component here, which is where your immune system turns against the body itself, and that somehow the COVID infection is leading to the body's immune system turning against itself. And this is an area where we still have a lot of questions as to why and how that might be happening. Is it, you know, is the infection completely gone or not in those settings? Is this entirely a dysfunctional, inappropriate immune response? Or is there even something else that we're not quite sure of yet?
And for children, do you have any thoughts on why children seem to have a lower rate of long COVID compared to men, as Dr. Hansen was saying?
Well, children are lower risk for severe COVID, so that's certainly protective. And we typically don't see autoimmune illnesses develop until a bit later in life, usually more commonly middle age. And so it's probably a function of just severity of illness and just how, it's probably a reflection of severity of illness and maturity of the immune system.
Mm. And for people who are dealing with long COVID today, each case can be different. What's the best way for individuals to navigate the systems and to live with what they have at the moment?
The challenge is we don't really have very good treatments for long COVID. It's about managing symptoms more than anything else. And so, you know, if you have shortness of breath, that might mean you need supplemental oxygen or pulmonary rehab, where you work with somebody to improve your breathing strength and muscles over time. If what you're dealing with is blood pressure problems, a lot of people who have long COVID will have difficulty standing because their blood pressure will drop when they stand. And so that might require things like really trying to stay well hydrated, taking certain medications to support your blood pressure, using compression stockings, and those kinds of things. So it really depends on what symptoms you're experiencing, what we have to offer. The other thing is that a lot of people who have long COVID also have social and financial needs. And so it's really important that the care of long COVID patients includes assistance from social workers, case managers, people who can help them navigate the system, whether that's applying for disability or it could be food stamps, it could be supports in the home to help you navigate cooking or bathing or, you know, all of those basic things that we all have to do for ourselves.
There's still so much we need to learn about long COVID. For the people who have it now and who have been suffering, they want to have an end date. Like, when is this all going to be over? Is there a way to even get some clarity on that question, Dr. Hansen?
We do see a recovery pattern of long COVID cases from the first 2 years of the pandemic. And from that recovery pattern, we estimate that the majority of long COVID cases do resolve, but also that some, about 15% of long COVID cases still have symptoms at a year from those follow-up studies. And so we're currently unclear how many long COVID cases go on to become chronic.
And Dr. Gounder, what's your experience and what are your thoughts in terms of answering a patient's question who says, doctor, how long is this going to last?
It really depends, again, on the type of long COVID. So is it the severe organ damage that would have occurred in the setting of a severe COVID infection? Most of those occurred in the first year or two of the pandemic. Some of that is permanent damage. You know, once you have permanent damage, heart failure, kidney failure, damage to the lungs, some of that is not reversible, will not improve over time. For people who developed that form of long COVID that's probably immune system related and can happen after a milder case of COVID, that form we have less information on. That may be reversible in certain settings, may improve in certain settings. But remember, we're only just now hitting year three of the pandemic, and so we have only that much information. And so it's really hard to say at this point.
Dr. Hansen, in your research, as you looked across the globe and looked at the data, was there anything that stood out to you in terms of differences between countries or regions?
One thing we noticed early on when we were gathering data is that anywhere that COVID patients are followed up long-term, long COVID was present and seen in the data. So, you know, early on it was wondered, oh, is this only in certain areas or you know, certain at-risk populations? But really anywhere it's looked for, it is there. And so geographic variation, we do see a little bit of it in the data, but it's unclear so far how much of that is noise in the data versus, you know, differences in the population level risk factors in the data, like you know, previous autoimmune diseases or other comorbidities, perhaps. So it's unclear right now exactly what the geographic variation is. There likely is some, as with all diseases, but right now, not enough data to really clarify what that difference is.
Well, there's so much interest in long COVID and how to find solutions for people who are suffering with it. We put out the question on social media for people to ask us anything to pass on to both of you. So let me start with Annie. Annie has this question. For people who test positive for COVID, does taking Paxlovid or other antivirals reduce the risk of developing long COVID? Dr. Gounder, do you want to start with that?
Sure. And this is being actively studied through NIH-funded trials right now. There is some preliminary data that would suggest that taking Paxlovid does indeed reduce your risk of going on to long COVID. So as an antiviral, it is blocking the viral replication cycle. And so if you have, dysfunctional autoimmune response that's being triggered by the infection, if you can stop the infection, stop the viral replication, it makes sense that taking Paxlovid might reduce your risk. There are drug-drug interactions that preclude the use of Paxlovid, but those are quite rare. And in almost all instances, you can manage that risk by just holding the regular medication, a patient's regular medication that might be, for example, a medication to reduce cholesterol. You can hold that medication for a couple days while somebody's taking Paxlovid and then restart. And for healthcare providers who might be listening, if you Google IDSA, the Infectious Disease Society of America, and Paxlovid drug interactions, there's a nice explanation there as to how you can manage those drug-drug interactions.
I agree with Dr. Gounder, and also kind of anything like Paxlovid or vaccination that reduces the severity of the COVID episode would reduce the risk of long-term symptoms too.
Let me ask a follow-up to this question, because Paxlovid is a prescription antiviral, and it's not available everywhere. It seems to be available more in the high-income countries. So what's the solution to get it into the low to middle-income countries, where long COVID, as you had mentioned, you see it everywhere?
Well, it's a great question. And even within the United States, you know, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, we see disparities within the U.S. as to who has access. We see disparities by geography, by race, by income. And so there really need to be intentional efforts made, one, to make the drug available in the country through perhaps reduced pricing. But then also, even once you make it available in a country, how do you distribute it? And in the United States, we have a program called Test to Treat, which rolled out perhaps a year or so ago now, in which there was a federal government initiative to try to scale up testing, particularly in underserved communities, but linking that testing with prescribing of the medication on site at the same location where you're getting your test. So you can imagine that might be places, for example, like retail pharmacies. In New York City, we've also had mobile vans going to underserved neighborhoods to try to provide on-the-spot testing and treatment. But it really requires not just supply of the drug, but a plan to distribute the drug.
Absolutely. It goes hand in hand.
I also want to note real quick, too, not everyone can take Paxlovid, too. So even if there is full access, it's, you know, it can't always be prescribed in every case or can't be tolerated by everyone, too.
Dr. Hansen, is it because of the age and the weight restrictions?
And comorbidities.
Okay. All right. So that's a great point to make. Not everyone can take it. We have another question from someone named Miss Scarlett. And Dr. Gounder, I'll give this one to you. And Dr. Hansen, let us know if you want to weigh in on this. How is the diagnosis made for long COVID? And what is the opinion on metformin on long COVID?
So this is a great question. This is not like, say, a heart attack, where we have blood tests, we know what it looks like on your EKG. There's not a test for long COVID. We basically add up the evidence. So did you have a COVID infection that we know of? Was there a lab test showing that you had COVID? Do you have the symptoms, signs that would be consistent with long COVID? Do you have the risk factors that might put you at higher risk for long COVID? And so we sort of add up all of those pieces to make a diagnosis. And I think that actually makes it very challenging because people then question it, whether it's maybe sometimes healthcare providers themselves, it could be federal agencies where when you're trying to apply for disability, it could be your employer who's questioning, well, how do you know that's really long COVID? And so I think that can make it very difficult on patients. With respect to metformin, metformin is a medication used to treat diabetes. And there was a study published recently, a preprint from The Lancet, that showed that people who took metformin were at lower risk of developing long COVID than people who did not take metformin. And there was a 42% reduction in long COVID, which was pretty significant. It was not a huge study, but it does seem to be a real signal. And so if you think about one of the risk factors for both severe COVID and long COVID is diabetes, and you're giving somebody a medication that manages diabetes, it makes sense that that would help reduce your risk of developing long COVID.
Dr. Hansen?
Yeah, no, nothing to add really. I think we all wish that there was a biomarker or a clear diagnostic criteria for long COVID. But it is, yeah, looking at the full symptom profile and kind of excluding other reasons for the symptoms that present.
All right, let's move on to the last question. It's from Rue. And Rue asks, has anyone tried PEMF or pulse electromagnetic field for long COVID? And this person says it actually fixes the issue. But you're both the doctors, so Dr. Hansen, tell me what you think.
Well, I'm not a medical doctor, so I'm more on the data side. I have not seen, kind of like we all want a, you know, clear diagnostic test or biomarker, we all want a silver bullet to cure long COVID. And there's just nothing so far, no evidence of anything that cures long COVID across the board. So I'm keeping my eye out for successful treatments, but haven't seen anything that, yeah, that cures long COVID.
Dr. Gounder, have you heard of this as a possible solution, PEMF?
I am not really that familiar with pulsed electromagnetic field therapy or PEMF. I know that from the NIH clinicaltrials.gov site, which is where clinical trials are required in the US to be registered if they're receiving NIH funding, there has been at least one trial that has been funded, but from what I can tell, they haven't actually started enrolling any patients. So I don't think we really have any data to support that as a treatment at this time.
So this is a call for more research, more data, and thank you both for your own work and your insight today, Dr. Sarah Wolf Hansen and Dr. Celine Gounder. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much for having us.